Welcome to Season 11, Episode 18 of the Ubuntu Podcast. In this episode, we're going to go over the community news and interview some of the developers behind the new Ubuntu community theme. We'll also go over your feedback. I'm Martin, and joining me this week is Alan.
Hello.
Just us again this week, no Mark.
Yes. Mark is having an extended holiday, well deserved.
Yeah, he is. I look forward to hearing what he's been up to. Hopefully not knocking in hotel bathrooms whilst he's been away in a rock and roll style. So what have you been up to since last time?
Gosh, I have been digging out a copy of Game Maker 1.4 for Windows, which may sound weird, but it's because you made a snap of a game called Spelunky HD Classic, or Classic HD, I think it is, which is available for Linux, and the developer open-sourced it many years ago. The developer open-sourced it and put the source code online. Somebody else has updated it a little bit and made a Linux build, and it's on GitHub. And you very kindly turned that into a snap so people could easily install it on their Linux systems.
You're welcome.
Snap install Spelunky. However, there is a bug in it. And there the bug isn't just in the snap. It's in the version that the other developer built. And it turns out that gamepads, joysticks don't work. And it's not just the Linux build that seems broken. The Windows build seems broken as well. So I thought, I'm sure we can fix this. It's open source after all. And then I realized it's written in Game Maker. So it's not something trivially easy to build. But then I remembered I have got a copy of Game Maker 1.4 that I acquired through a Humble Bundle some years ago. And I've never used it. I've had it and I think I installed it on a laptop years ago, but never actually used it. And so I dug it out, installed it, opened the source code for Spelunky, and I've never used Game Maker before, but I figured out how to tweak the code, read the documentation, and fixed it. So now you can use Xbox 360 controllers and other types of controllers with the Spelunky Snap.
Fantastic. Yeah, because this was the only bit of feedback we got after we'd snapped this thing, which was the controller support was a bit dodgy in that I think one button triggered or something.
The A button, that you can jump, but you can't do anything else.
Yeah.
But it turns out the function that the developer originally used only works on the Windows version of Game Maker and doesn't work on Linux builds. So I had to use a different function, this gamepad function. And as soon as I started editing the code and just changed it to look for you pressing left, right, up and down and pressing all the various buttons, it just started working. It was really, really easy and I could build it. Then I had to create an Ubuntu 14.04 VM to build the Linux version because that's the way Game Maker works.
Right. You're using Game Maker on a Windows workstation.
Yeah.
And then you click like build Linux and it wants to connect to some Linux box somewhere to do the actual composition.
It basically SSH, you have to give it all the details for a Linux box, and the only supported Linux is Ubuntu 14.04, if you look at their documentation. And you just prep a VM running 14.04, apt install a bunch of things, give it SSH access, and then when you press the build Linux version in Game Maker, it SSHs over to the Linux machine, assembles everything, and then brings it back over the network to the Windows machine, and there you've got your Linux build.
Brilliant.
Simples.
I don't know, you and me, preserving classic games since 2018.
Brilliant.
Right then, we're going to round up some community news and events. And the first bit of community news that I saw this week is that Ubuntu Studio have released a free guide to audio production on Linux.
Oh, wow. What? Like a book type thing?
Yes, it's a PDF type thing.
Oh, nice.
And it's pitched at amateurs and semi-professional audio enthusiasts and covers how to make music and audio production using Ubuntu Studio and free software.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and this is... So There's a bit of a renaissance going on in the Ubuntu Studio team at the moment. You know, they had some difficulty where the team was a bit time compressed and they weren't able to work on things as rapidly as they wanted to. And there's been some new community members joining that team. And not only is Ubuntu Studio getting some active development for what will be 18.10, but there's initiatives like this underway, which I think is a really great idea, because we're hearing increasingly that Linux generally is being used for, you know, media creation, you know, videos and audio. So it's good to be able to put these tools with some instruction material in the hands of people. I think that's great.
Yeah, well done then. Next up, we've had a blog post from Will Cook, a first look at desktop metrics. Now, as we record this, that post has been around for a little while, so you've probably already seen this and heard a lot of feedback about it, but it would be remiss of us not to link to it. So you may remember that 1804 has a tool called Ubuntu Report, which can optionally gather some basic hardware information, and that gets sent off to a secure locker somewhere in the canonical vaults. And Will has extracted some of the information and presented it in graphical form with a little bit of commentary. Not all the data's there, so it's got stuff like what display sizes people use and what disk partitioning schemes, CPU count, and a few other interesting metrics about people who install Ubuntu 1804, amount of RAM and stuff like that. And it's funny, if you look at the commentary online, it's split 50-50 between people who are surprised at one or other of the figure and the other 50% of people who are not remotely surprised by anything in this page. Take it with a pinch of salt. It's early days, and as more and more people install 1804 and more people opt into this, the data will become more useful, and I'm sure Will and the team will extract more interesting data and make that available in future posts.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Was there anything in there that particularly caught your attention?
Not especially. I mean, I was interested at things like the display resolutions, like the fact that 1080p and 1366 by 768 were very prominent. But actually, when you look at things like the Steam hardware survey, that's exactly the same two resolutions that are super popular on on Linux machines that have Steam installed. So it's good to see that that data correlates with other people who've done this kind of metrics. And similarly, the Mozilla have also done some metrics collection, and there's some correlation with things that they've collected as well. So it's all good stuff.
Yeah. Next, we have an announcement that Ubuntu 16.04 LTS has been certified for a range of Intel NUCs. So there's the Dawson Canyon NUCs, of which there are 9 models of 7th gen NUCs, which are now Ubuntu certified. And there's also the June Canyon NUC, of which there are 2 models of 7th gen NUCs. And this sort of passed me by when I first sort of glanced at this blog post when it passed across my desk, but I didn't realize at the time that this is specific images of Ubuntu Core for these devices and also specific images of Ubuntu Desktop.
So when you say specific images, they're modified in some way to support the newest generation of chipset and GPUs and other bits inside those cases.
They are bespoke for the hardware in these NUCs. So when you go to the blog post, which is in the show notes, if you have one of these NUCs, there will be download links that are specifically prepared ISO images with all of the goodness that you need baked into those ISO images, which I think's pretty remarkable.
That's really good.
Long may it continue. I look forward to the sexy NUCs, such as the Skull Canyon and the Hades Canyon, to this program.
Where do these fit? Like, so all these, I just see a bunch of canyons and I've got no idea where they fit. Just briefly.
So you remember the original, the Hades and Skull Canyon are you referring to, or just generally these ones?
Well, like, as far as I know, you have the very latest Hades Canyon,
mm-hmm.
and before that there was a Skull Canyon. Are these mm-hmm. chronologically just older than that, or newer than that, or what?
These are newer than my Skull Canyon, Nuck.
Mm-hmm.
The Dawson Canyon and Dune Canyon,
mm-hmm.
but they are the traditional Nucks. So if you've seen those square-shaped Nucks,
oh, yes.
these are traditional Nucks, whereas my Skull Canyon and Hades Canyon are RGB to the max gamer versions.
Gotcha, gotcha. Yeah. With the big skull on the outside.
Yes, all that stuff, yeah.
I see. Next up, the Zubuntu development team have posted an update for June and July 2018.
Yeah.
Simon's shared some details about plans for Zubuntu. This is good. What's in the plan?
So they're working towards a release of XFCE 4.14, which is the release that will feature GTK3 in all of the components. Oh. So they're now hoping that that will be concluded sometime in the next year. And they've outlined 11 projects that have been already updated in pursuit of that goal.
So is that how eradicating GTK2 across the board?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So, you know, they obviously... It's risky to make such a big change for an LTS release. So now LTS is out of the way, you know, they're focused on their next round of iterations and, you know, the next 2-year cycle. So working towards GTK3 everywhere. And then the other interesting nugget that was in here is Ubuntu in 18.04 introduced this ability to have the minimal install, which is a tick box in the installer that is exposed to the user if that flavor of Ubuntu has opted into the minimal install program,
mm-hmm.
which Zubuntu didn't do because
in 1804, right?
Because they have been preparing their own what they call Zubuntu Core ISO images for a few years now, which are a specially prepared ISO image which is minimal by default.
Right.
And what they're going to be doing is, instead of taking advantage of the minimal install feature, they have already committed all of their changes. So what's now called the Zubuntu base ISO images are now official images within the Ubuntu build infrastructure.
So thinking about, like, technically the way the minimal install is implemented, it's mm-hmm. it's like, I don't think anyone is going to be upset by me saying it's a bit of a hack that clicking that minimal install button actually does the install and then rips out a bunch of packages in order to wind the clock back and get you a lighter weight systems. But what they're doing is the other way around,
yes.
in inverted commas, the right way, which is building up from a very, very lean base.
Yes.
So it's just super clean.
Yeah. So they just have things that are not present at all in the first place, right. and you choose to install that leaner version of Ubuntu.
I can see that being very attractive because that'll be a super fast install. There'll be less data to transfer. Yes. I guess the ISO image is smaller.
Smaller ISO images, faster install time.
Nice. That's really good work. It's great to see these public development update blogs coming out.
Yep.
Well, long may it continue.
Yep. And we've got some events. The first is Og Camp, which is taking place from the 18th to the 19th of August in Sheffield in the UK at Sheffield Hallam University. So if you're not going, get your tickets and come. And if you are going, make sure you book your accommodation, including us.
yes.
What other event have we got?
One other event, Libre Applications Summit, which is from the 6th to the 9th of September 2018. It's in Denver, Colorado. It's sponsored by GNOME and SUSE and System 76, I believe. And it's a developer-focused event. And quoting from them, it's focused on building an application market for Linux and creating an ecosystem that addresses barriers to building such an application market. So I think it's aimed at developers and all the things developers need to build applications for Linux and get those applications out to users. Mm. I think they've got a call for papers right now and invitation. I think they ran this last year. They had something around 60 attendees. And this time, I think they're aiming to get double that or more.
Okay. So if you're in the US or you want to travel to this event, we'll have a link in the show notes and you can find out more.
Thank you. we've got a special interview today. We've got three members of the team who created the community theme you may have heard us talk about quite a bit. We've got Mads, Frederick, and Carlo. Hello, guys. How are you doing?
Hello.
Hello.
Brilliant. So many voices. We don't usually have this many people on, so I hope we can cope. So maybe, Mads, if I turn to you first, what is, like, for people who've not heard of it, what is the community theme and where did it come from?
Well, it's a new theme, a new design for Ubuntu, which I think the community has been asking for a very long time.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. And how did it all kick off? If people keep asking for it for years, and you're right, like people have said, Ubuntu's looked the same for 5 years. What do you think sparked it off this time? What made it actually take?
I think someone suggested to Didier that the community could create the team and not Canonical, and I think he rang with that.
And do you think that was enough spark to get people involved, right?
Yeah.
And just for context there, this is Didier Roche, who was one of the engineers on the Ubuntu desktop team.
Right. And so how did you all get involved? Was it something that passed by in your newsreader, or were you invited to get involved? How did it manifest itself for you guys?
Well, I was looking at the community hub. I get maybe by chance, because I read first the announcement about the idea to kick off this new project, and I replied with something very generic, actually, like I'll do what I can. I'll be happy to do what I can, and basically that's it. I was looking for a way to contribute, and I found it right away.
Had you been looking for a way to contribute for long? In fact, this is a question for all of you. Had you all been looking for a way to contribute to Ubuntu, or did you just see this and it was something that you could contribute to?
I've started actually 1 year before that, contributed with some patches for Ambience and Radiance as well.
Right, okay. And Frederick, yourself?
It was actually the first time I contributed anything else than bug reports. Yes.
Right, and Carlo.
Yeah, I contributed with previously with Ambience and Radiance, and also in Zapcraft, now that I remember.
Oh, wow. Awesome. You get around.
Yeah, I was looking for anything to help.
So where do you start with the theme? Like who? What do you do first? Do you like? I can't imagine how you start with a theme. Is it like the icons you do first? Do you like sketch it out on paper? Where do you start with this?
Well, luckily we started from a base already developed. For the GTK3 theme, we started from Advaita, the default GNOME theme. So we modified that. Mm-hmm. The icon set is the one from Unity 8, Suru icon. And Shell as well started from the default one. We modified that.
And how are the three of you collaborating on this? How do you share your ideas? Where do you come together and agree how you're going to tackle new icons and theme ideas?
We use the Community Hub, and we use GitHub, and we use Telegram.
Okay. And have the three of you actually met in person, or are you doing this all remotely?
Yeah, totally remotely.
Okay. And whereabouts are the three of you dotted around the world?
I think we're on the same line, basically, in Italy, Germany, and Denmark.
Exactly.
Oh, so it's convenient you're in the same time zone.
And how have you found contributing to this effort? You say that there was some dialogue with Didier. What did the Ubuntu desktop team to facilitate this?
Yeah, the thread on the Community Hub that Didier started is actually at 1,400 comments at this moment.
Wow.
Wow.
That's got to be like the longest thread on the entire site.
I would think so. And actually, there's a few subcategories which isn't included.
Oh, right. You've got a private area. Yes. Like, okay. And was that really just to stop the thing getting bogged down with loads of people throwing their opinion in but not actually contributing in any way? Or was there nothing? Yeah, is that all
intention,
it was?
But
well, I'd say that even contributing with just ideas or positive or negative feedbacks is good enough. I mean, not everybody can actually contribute with something, but just even having people saying good work, it's very good.
Yeah. I think that the general feedback has been good.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you know, I guess part of that is, you know, we haven't had a new theme for a long time and people are clamoring to get whatever they can. But also, you've done a really good job. Like, all the, whenever I see someone post about it, the screenshots always look really nice. And the progression from what it initially started out to now has come quite a long way. Did you think that would be the case? Or did you think this would just be a small project that would just fall by the wayside and it wouldn't actually succeed?
I was very surprised that it was such a huge effort. I think Canonical should have done this a long time ago, but I did not know that it would take so much time. So it's very understandable.
Right.
You're referring to the time and energy required to create a new theme.
And what are the challenges there? I mean, someone might say, oh, well, it's just a theme and a bunch of icons, and there are plenty of those online. You can throw one of those together easily. What are the challenges in this? I've never done this, and I'm sure many of our listeners haven't. So what are the challenges there?
Well, basically, the main challenge is that you're working on the real theme. I mean, you open a window, and you have to understand what's its structure, where to look for the files that define a widget or a color or a line. It's not so easy. Luckily, GNOME has a nice tool called GDK Inspector that shows the hierarchy of the widgets in any application. And there's only one major problem, that it shows the CSS of the application. While we are developing in SAS, there's one step in between. So we have to look for the structure of the application and then understand where to look in the files to change something.
So if I understand this right, there's a whole bunch of theme like files, these CSS files, and you have to fiddle with like the hex color values right. Okay. I remember when we first did the theme for that went in, I think, was it 1710? It was very hastily thrown together, and we were doing, we were searching and replacing, you know, hex strings. Is it? I know some people might think it is as simple as that, but there's obviously a lot more to it than that, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of work. Even just to understand the code base, it's a lot of work.
Yeah, so I think what you're alluding to here is you actually have to go and look at the source code for the applications in order to fully understand what style classes they're using to correctly, like, implement the theme that you want, the look that you want.
Yeah, luckily enough, that was necessary. It's only for very few applications, like browsers. But using the GDK Inspector, you can inspect the application without having the source code. So I have the list of classes and styles and colors and values, everything. It's very, very useful. It's extremely useful.
And while you're working on this theme specifically as the default theme for Ubuntu, is this a theme that will work on other desktop environments?
It's a GNOME, GNOME 3 or a GDK, GDK 3 theme, so it works on GDK 3 themes and GDK 2. But we are that's one of the portions what's really not sorted out at the moment. But it works. The GDK 3 theme works, but it needs some work.
So is this packaged up in a way that, you know, people can easily get hold of the work that you've done and track what you're doing? Is it something people can just, or do people need to go and get a tarball and build stuff and, like, install in dangerous places or something? How easy is it for people to actually try this out?
Yeah, we are releasing it as a snap package. We have two different channels, one for the age, which is we get every new update as soon as we push it. And every week we release a stable release instead. So snap is the main channel to release it. But also, I mean, of course, if people go to GitHub and they can install it basically everywhere. We have for sure one user in Arch. The only problem was probably GNOME Shell, but I think he figured out how to to use even the GNOME shell part of the style.
Snaps are also a fantastic tool when we have to test the pull requests. We can easily roll back and forth between testing code.
And are you like running this on your main machine? Are you like, you know, using it, dog fooding the actual theme on your main machine so you can see when
I
these problems occur?
I have set up a VR because then I know it's a clean install. I didn't mess anything up.
Right.
Yeah, I installed directly the source code because I need to tweak it, to patch it. And I have a virtual machine for releasing the snap.
When are you anticipating that this theme will become the default theme in an Ubuntu release?
It's expected to be released as default in the next one, in 18.10.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. I heard a rumor that it may be released as into one of the 18.04 point releases. Is that going to happen, or is
that
just a filthy rumor?
So. Because there's a snap you can install, so...
Yeah.
Right. I think I heard that in a dream, or maybe I made it up one day. I can't remember. And then, you know, I get shouted out by someone telling me, no, we're not going to do that.
As Matt said, you can install it right away in 18.4. And the plan is that it will be promoted at some point in the software center, hopefully with some shiny icon.
Ooh.
Also, I think it's the first theme that can be installed by GNOME software application from the graphical user interface.
That's right.
Usually you have to install something with terminal or downloading .gz file. And this is the first one, if I'm not wrong, that can be installed by graphical user interface. So it's pretty easy actually to do.
Oh, that's awesome. Oh, that's really cool, because like that's always one of those, you know, tricky things is how do you actually get it, and then if it hoses your system, how do you get rid of it afterwards? And, that's, you know, something I worry about, I know, and I'm sure other people do as well. How is it just the three of you who work on this along with Didier? Is there other people who've contributed? Do you get drive-by contributions? What's that like?
Well, we have another designer, Stefan, and another developer, Aaron. But we got contribution PRs and even from other people from time to time. So it's a wider group of people.
Awesome. And what's your like feeling of like now you're getting close to 18.10 and, you know, it's going to land and lots of people are going to see this, you know, potentially millions of people are going to see this as their default experience. How does that make you feel that you know, this is landing in front of so many people?
Yeah, proud, I guess. I'm waiting for my colleagues to install it at work and see. Like, let's see that. Do you like it?
I mean,
yeah, kind of.
Awesome. And for anyone listening to this that thinks, "Ooh, I've got some design flair or a really good idea," how can they get involved in the process of assisting you? And is there any particular help that you're looking for?
GTK2.
Is that the main standout thing? That's the skills that people need. You're looking for.
Yeah, it's actually important, especially for we're planning to implement the Qt theming, which works with the GTK2 theme.
That's right. Yeah,
and that's why we really need some help with the GTK2 theming, because it should at least cover most of the styles we use in the GTK3 theme.
I'm reluctant to volunteer myself, but I do actually understand how all of that stuff works, having done it fairly recently. So ideally, somebody else should come and volunteer themselves to help you. But if you don't get any help with that, ping me and I'll see if I can make some time to come and give you a hand on that one.
And is this, like you said, the organization is all done via the community hub, and you've got a Telegram channel for quick communication, and then issues are done via GitHub. Everything's hosted on GitHub, I take
right.
it.
There's been 400 issues on GitHub. Yeah. So that's a lot of work and a lot of conversations.
In general terms, what do those issues sort of, you know, what are the topics of those issues, generally speaking?
Awful colors? No, I mean, I'm joking.
Mostly orange.
Orange.
I mean, they're mostly opinions, which is fine, but and a big bunch of actual bugs, like mixed styles and colors or things that we don't expect to see. But yeah, most of the time are discussions and opinion even there. Matt before said we reached, I don't know, thousands of comments in the hub, but consider also that every thread in the bug tracker on GitHub as well. So a long discussion everywhere.
Wow.
This is amazing. There's the three of you, and you've mentioned two other people who are contributing significantly. All of these thousands of comments and 400 issues. This has more people and sort of momentum and interest behind it than many sort of other open source projects. So congratulations to all of you on creating a vibrant community around this endeavor. Fantastic effort.
Do you think, is this something that you're going to have to keep maintaining, or do you think you're going to get to a point where it's pretty much done and it goes into maintenance mode? What do you think there?
I'm sorry, to be fair, I just remember there's one other guy that helped us a lot, which is Merlin, that implemented all the CI integration and automatic build. So just to remember this because it's important.
Yeah, sure, definitely.
Actually, I don't know. There will be a point when the theme will be stable enough to go in maintenance, but actually I didn't think about that yet.
Well, right. The question is how hard the GNOME guys will change their theming. That's a question.
So it's a constant job to keep up with upstream changes that you have to follow. I see.
Also, right. Even GTK4 one day will come. And probably we need to tweak something to adapt.
Right. Amazing. I think the work you guys have done and all those involved in the project is just fantastic. I remember the very first conversations about, you know, having a chat with Will on the desktop team and Didier and talking about, wouldn't it be great if we had a new theme, and it would be really awesome if the community got around it and, you know, got together and built something awesome. And here we are, months and months and months later, and you guys have done it. I think it's just fantastic, and I wish you all the best and hope more people get involved in this. What's the GitHub project where people can find it?
It's called, on Ubuntu naming, it's GTK-community theme, which is the main one, the main project. Uh-huh. And, I mean, we'll be announced in a couple of weeks the new name, but for up to now,
is a working title.
Is it? Yeah, it's a code name or something like that.
Oh, I didn't know that. Today I learned.
I thought this was the final name. I didn't realize there was some super secret name that you guys are hiding from us.
Well, actually, some names got out a couple of months ago.
I'm not going to look for them. I like surprises. Right. I'll wait for the surprise. So it's been great having you on. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this. And obviously, thank you so much for working on the community theme. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to all of the positive reviews that this is undoubtedly going to get when 18.10 comes out.
And all the screenshots and like all these YouTube videos and screenshots that are going to appear, that are going to be in print forever, that are going to have the theme that you created. It's fantastic. It's so exciting. So yes, thank you again, take care. See you again soon.
Are you looking after your bits? If you are, help your fellow listeners keep their bits safe too. If there's a VPN or privacy service that you've found useful, email your virtual private love to show@ubuntupodcast.org.
And now it's time for all your wonderful feedback. Squiggly left a comment on our Telegram channel, ubuntupodcast.com/telegram, about DIY home routers.
After running DDWRT for years and years, I finally had enough and wanted something with more capabilities and more control. I got myself a mini PC, which costs less than a high-end router with dual gigabit Ethernet, 4 gigs, fast M2 SSD, and slapped pfSense on it. From my experience, anything that runs BSD derivatives will almost run any Linux distro, Triskel aside, perfectly fine. And he gave a link to the box, which came from AliExpress. Mm. He said there's four different models with four or six NICs, varying CPUs, RAMs, SSDs. We got a lot of feedback about this. I put out a mention a few weeks ago about the fact that I was looking to replace my home router and maybe replace it with an x86-based machine that I could have the flexibility to install anything, maybe pfSense, maybe Ubuntu Core, maybe something else. So we got a lot of feedback about this, and I appreciate all the feedback we've had. I haven't done anything about it yet other than absorb all this feedback and watch loads of videos and read loads of reviews. So I welcome all the feedback. And if you have any more, then please do keep sending it in. John emailed the show to show@ubuntupodcast.org, also on that subject.
Yeah, and he says he's been running his own router since about 2011. Global Scale had a booth at Scale in Los Angeles, and among their products was a small device, the Dream Plug, that could run a somewhat specialized version of Linux that had two Ethernet ports, and it only drew a quarter of a watt. And he says that he recalls that the throughput of this was sufficient for his broadband at the time and served him for several years. And then he goes on to say that he then replaced that with a Raspberry Pi Model B running Raspbian with a slightly more complex set of firewall rules and IP tables and what have you. And he says, and yes, the Raspberry Pi only had one Ethernet port, but he was able to use a USB dongle to create the second Ethernet port, and it was effective up to 35 megabits a second, which was also fine at the time for, you know, his broadband requirements, and has recently switched to an Odroid C2, which has gigabit Ethernet, although it's still limited to USB 2 bus speeds. But it turns out that the USB 3 Ethernet adapter will operate at 100 megabits per second, and that's what he's currently paying for, and he's able to use Diet Pi on this device to sustain 100 megabits per second as his router. And he says, if you haven't heard about Diet Pi, you should take a look. I've not given it a full shakeout, but everything I've tried works as described.
Good to know.
Gordon Campbell also emailed us at show@ubuntupodcast.org.
There is a reason why you can't find a current step-by-step way of setting up a router under Ubuntu. pfSense is so vastly wonderful that it would be stupid to use a different approach on an x86 machine. As for hardware, a Z-Box or Z-Box is a nice way to get two Ethernet ports on a small form factor computer. A Z-Box is a tiny bit expensive for what it is. Yes, I have set up pfSense on a Z-Box, and it was one of the simplest installations I've ever done. With pfSense, you won't even be aware that the OS is BSD, because you're never exposed to the OS. Even backup is done from within pfSense. Mm-hmm. We've had a fair number of people say that pfSense is super awesome.
Yes, pfSense is the cat's pajamas. I used to use it at a previous job in our data centers as our firewall at the entry point of our racks, and even doing complicated things like having two installations of pfSense that were clustered, so that if one of them suffered a hardware failure, the other would automatically pick up and carry on, and you wouldn't even, you know, miss a beat. It was very, very simple to do complicated stuff.
Nice. John B. Courtright emailed us.
He says, regarding Season 11, Episode 13, Alan mentioned investigating a possible DIY Ubuntu Core router. I have been pondering this too. I'm curious to see what you come up with, as I've just started looking into it.
I suspect I won't be done doing this until after the summer, so ask me again then.
Yeah, so I think this will crop up in What Have We Been Up To, or maybe a segment later in the year. And yes, I did notice, for your interest, Alan, there is a routing snap recently entered the Snap Store from a provider of networking equipment. So perhaps there might be an option there.
Mm.
Sturmflirt joined our Telegram channel to tell us,
was that the 8086 was called 8086 because it had eight 16-bit registers, claim from season 11, episode 14 and a half, ever backed up with evidence beside the linked extremetech.com article, by the way? Because I happen to have read a lot of the original publications of the 8086, and that claim is, to my knowledge, never made. Also, the designer never talks about eight 16-bit registers in the chip, but 12 plus 1. The 8086 number seems to have been assigned before the project was started by simply putting it after the 8085 to not detract any attention from the 8800. Most of the material is now locked away behind paywalls in the IEEE archives, but Stephen P. Morse wrote his own 47-page history of the 8086, which is free to read, and he provides a link. The 5 in 8085 stands for 5 volts, by the way, one of the few cases in which Intel's part numbering ever followed some logic. The numbering scheme we use today is not even the real one used anymore back then, but exists just for marketing purposes. The internal ordering code for an Intel Core i9-7980XE Extreme Edition processor is CD80673037349O2, for example.
Uh-huh.
I think we get the point, yes.
Bonkers naming conventions. And no, the article that I got that 8 16-bit registers from, I took at face value because it was an interview with the chip designer. So if that's not the case, I apologize.
Glenn Maloney emailed us.
As a Unity desktop fan, I was wondering if you guys have an opinion to my question. If you had the choice of using either Ubuntu 16.04 or Ubuntu 18.04 with Unity enabled, which would you choose and why? Does the support differ from either one? Also, is there any news regarding the Unity Remix spin?
Ooh, that's a good question.
You answer the first question about 16.04 and 18.04 with Unity.
So I used that exact setup. So up until a few months ago, I was on Ubuntu 16.04 until a while after 18.04 came out. I stuck on 16.04 and used a triple display laptop with it, and everything was funky, and I loved it, and there was nothing really wrong with it, actually.
This is funky in a good way.
Funky, yeah, funky great.
Yeah.
Then I upgraded to 18.04, but I continued to use Unity because I wanted the latest stuff, and 16.04 was never going to give me the latest stuff. So I thought I'd move to 18.04, and I kept Unity for a while, and then I thought, okay, I'll give this GNOME shell a try again, because I did try that a couple of years back. And I tried Unity for a while, then switched to GNOME shell. So right now I'm running GNOME shell, but if you're a massive fan of Unity, then I would probably say 16.04 is fine for now. Maybe upgrade to, I would say 16.04 for Unity and upgrade to 18.04 when 18.04.1 comes out at the end of July. That would be my opinion.
Yep. And with regards to the Ubuntu Unity Remix, work is still ongoing. I know they've had some sad news within their team with regard to illnesses and what have you. But as far as I understand it, they're on schedule to debut with Ubuntu 18.10 as an official flavor. So watch this space.
Cool.
Somebody with a name I can't even begin to pronounce emailed us.
Yeah, I was trying to read it and it, I can't. Thought I'd mention that while your website itself is hosted via HTTPS, the download links for your MP3 files are served over HTTP without any HTTPS option. I believe you covered this news item on the show on why this is a bad idea. It just seems that a technology podcast should adopt best practices and serve everything on their website via HTTPS only. Again, love the show. Keep up the good work. Like Alan's 8-bit restoration projects and Martin's knuck work. Oh, thank you for the kind words.
Thank you. Yeah. So just to be clear, when we were talking about HTTP, I don't think we said it was a bad idea. I think this was some time ago and we were talking about ISO downloads being available via HTTP. And the fact that at that time there were still people with Windows XP trying to download those ISO images. And if we had made those HTTPS, they wouldn't have been able to access those downloads. However, the fact that our MP3s for our podcast are HTTP only is just a massive oversight and all my fault, and we'll fix it soon.
Excellent. Par Moberg emailed us.
Why does Snaps create English versions of my home folder in my home folder? I have a Swedish install with the Swedish names for desktop, document, etc. When I run a Snap, it adds empty folders with the English names of the default folders. Why is this happening? Is Snap not internationalized?
I think isn't this down to a piece of reusable code called the desktop launcher, which does some magic to make those directories appear for snaps because the snaps won't see them by default. Yes. And I think there was a bug in that it made an assumption about the directory names. And I believe it's fixed now.
It is fixed now, yes. So if the snap has been built, I think, any time within the last sort of 4 weeks or so, this bug is fixed and that you won't get the duplication of the folders and the snaps will recognize the localized folder names that already exist in your home directory. Mm-hmm. However, if the snap was built prior to those 4 weeks ago, it will be doing what you've described here, in which case I suggest you file a bug against the snap in question and kindly request that they rebuild their snap to pull in the fixes.
Awesome. Thank you.
Well, that's all for episode 18. That's another bumper edition. That's three on the bounce that have been well over half an hour now. We're going to have to rein it in.
It's a biggie.
Yeah.
Yes. Maybe we need to get Mark back to tell us to shut up and stop gabbling.
Yeah, keep things succinct. Yeah, otherwise the listeners are going to get used to these epic episodes.
They're going to have to extend their commute.
Drive around the block a couple more times on the way home, that sort of thing. Right, well, that's it. We'll see you all next time.